The parade was a celebration of the Greek god Dionysus, whom the Ptolemies had elegantly associated with their new Egyptian deity Serapis. At its centre came a four-wheeled wagon, 14 cubits, 21 feet, high, and 8 cubits, 12 feet, wide. It was drawn by 180 men. On it was the image of Dionysus, 10 cubits, 15 feet, high. If the sheer scale of this statue were not impressive enough, it also appeared to the crowd to be magical, moving of its own accord. He was pouring libations from a golden goblet, and had a purple tunic reaching to his feet. In front of him lay a Lacedaemonian goblet of gold holding 15 measures of wine, and a golden tripod in which was a golden incense burner, and 2 golden bowls full of cassia and saffron, and a shade covered it round adorned with ivy and vine leaves and all other kinds of greenery. Athenaeus of Naucratis, De Hypnosophists, or The Learned Banquet. More wagons laden with gilded bowls and tripods followed, along with a display from the royal menagerie consisting of 24 chariots drawn by 4 elephants each, 12 chariots drawn by antelopes, 15 by buffaloes, 8 by pairs of ostriches, 8 by zebras, and 24 by lions. There was also one final scene of conspicuous consumption. A wagon, 40 feet long and 15 feet wide, trundled down the granite road drawn by 600 men. On this wagon was a sack holding 3,000 measures of wine and consisting of leopard skins sewn together. This sack allowed its liquor to escape, and it gradually flowed over the whole road. The cost of this great occasion was 2,239 talents and 50 minae. Athenaeus of Naucratis, De Hypnosophists, or The Learned Banquet. At the time of the above translation in 1998, that quantity of gold would have cost the modern equivalent of roughly $35 million, a sizable amount to spend on a single parade. These parades also carried political messages, in this case Ptolemaic solidarity with the Grecian city-states of the Corinthian League, and were deliberately designed to impress the local diplomatic corps as well as visiting delegations with the raw wealth and power of the new rulers of Egypt. In all this, they were highly successful, and Ptolemy II, with his immaculately harnessed economic machine, could well afford them. He seems not to have recognized, however, that such ostentatious displays have a certain addictive quality. Once you've done a few, everybody expects the delightful new tradition to continue indefinitely, with disastrous consequences for later, less financially adroit Ptolemies and their decadent, pleasure-addicted courts. A further pull on the royal purse strings came from the priests and temples of the Egyptian state religion. The Egyptians in Ptolemy's kingdom did not require him simply to put on impressive shows, however much they may have enjoyed them. For them, their ruler had a far more spiritual role, mediating between the gods and men. A pharaoh had to perform the vital religious rituals which ensured that Maat, harmony or stability, remained in Egypt, so one of his greatest financial obligations was toward the temples. But maintaining buildings was never enough for true Egyptian pharaohs. Egypt was a country defined by its monumental buildings, where kings had turned whole cliff faces into statues, where the Great Pyramid still remained far and away the largest and, to many, the most mysterious structure on earth. If the Ptolemies wanted to rule this country in a way that inspired Egyptians and overawed Greeks, they would have to build temples. Building temples was also about building bridges. The introduction of the Serapis cult had ushered in a small reformation in Egyptian religion, which must have left many temple priests on edge. The government's shift from Memphis to Alexandria must also have rankled. But like Alexander before them, both Ptolemy I and his son knew that their positions ultimately depended on retaining harmonious relations with the Egyptian priesthood, as the priests influenced the will of the people. Temple building eased this pressure by investing state funds in the priestly caste and by reminding the guardians of Egyptian religion that their new Greek masters respected and needed them. A little wonder, then, that all the Ptolemies were powerful supporters of religious institutions, right through to the great Cleopatra VII, whose image, along with that of her son by Julius Caesar, appears carved in bas-relief on one of the pylons of her temple at Hathor at Dendera. In fact, Their programs of temple building and restoration were so extensive throughout Egypt that most of the buildings which tourists visit today and assume to be of ancient Egypt were either built or restored under the Ptolemies. When walking through the almost perfectly preserved first pylon of the Temple of Horus at Edfu, we are not walking into the world of Ramesses and Tutankhamun, but into a creation of Ptolemy II's son. The Temple of Isis at Philae, so spectacularly saved by UNESCO from the rising waters of Lake Nasser, stands on remains from more ancient times, but is itself a work of the later Ptolemies, and was decorated in the time of Roman rule. The temples at Esna and Komombo, likewise, were not even thought of when Ptolemy II paraded through the streets of Alexandria. Although these buildings have become our image of ancient Egypt, they are themselves just a dream, imaginings by Greek rulers of what were already the long-lost days of the pyramid builders. But if the new temples springing up across Egypt in Ptolemy II's reign were simply harking back to older times, they were certainly not without value to their native audience. In preserving and developing their religious patronage, these places also kept indigenous art traditions and scholarship alive. All over Egypt today you can see pharaohs and their queens carved in traditional stances, wearing traditional Egyptian clothing and jewelry, brandishing traditional weapons and adornments, and smiting the enemy in entirely traditional manners. They might in fact be images of Greek-speaking Macedonians, but to the ultra-conservative Egyptians they were good enough, reminding them of their illustrious past and offering the tantalizing possibility that those days had now returned. This extensive investment in Egyptian culture had other benefits beyond simply keeping the priesthood and peasantry happy. Under Ptolemaic patronage, Egyptian intellectual life flourished. Not just the spoken word, but both hieroglyphic and demotic writing blossomed, while the need for translation gave rise to perhaps the most important surviving object from ancient Egypt, the Rosetta Stone, whose parallel texts in hieroglyphics, demotic, another more cursive Egyptian script, and Greek, provided the key to the decoding of the hieroglyphs. And with new styles of writing came new subject matters, including a new Egyptian literary style of romantic tales told in story cycles, and featuring the gods, royalty, magic, romance, and the mighty deeds of their warrior heroes. Even in this halcyon period, there was a much darker undercurrent flowing through the Ptolemaic family arteries. The rule of the Ptolemies, like those in the other successor states to Alexander's empire, was a family affair. And within that tortuously intermarried and interbred family, deadly rivalries were already brewing. Around 300 BC, Ptolemy I had arranged for his 16-year-old daughter, Arsinoe, to marry King Lysimachus of Thrace, who had also been in the entourage of Alexander the Great. A clever tactical move, as after 285 BC, Lysimachus also became king of Macedonia. Now the Ptolemies could hold out the prospect of inheriting Alexander's original patrimony, for if Lysimachus and Arsinoe had a son, then Ptolemaic blood would run through the veins of the next ruler of Macedon. There was a problem, however. The king already had an heir, Agathocles, by a previous wife. So Arsinoe, with characteristic Ptolemaic ruthlessness, quickly set about arranging his death. But in the highly interrelated families of the Mediterranean, things were never so simple. And after his murder, Agathocles' widow fled the country and managed to raise a war against Lysimachus, in which the king was eventually killed, 281 BC. It was a disaster for Arsinoe, and in the ensuing confusion, Lysimachus's Thracian throne was seized by Arsinoe's half-brother, who demanded that she marry him. If on the surface this looked like another triumph for the Ptolemies, however, the truth was very different. The marriage to Arsinoe had nothing to do with family, beyond gaining access to her children, who the usurper knew were the rightful heirs to Macedon and Thrace. But escaping the marriage proved impossible, and not long after the ceremony her sons by Lysimachus were duly murdered. With no further need for her, she was expelled from the kingdom. Her half-brother had only wanted her hand in marriage so he could kill her children. This, then, was the brutalized and vengeful woman who a few months later arrived back at her brother Ptolemy II's court in Alexandria around 279 BC. Here she continued to intrigue, this time aiming her venom at the king's wife, also confusingly called Arsinoe the First. Arsinoe the First was incidentally the daughter of Lysimachus, and thus, theoretically, Arsinoe the Second's stepdaughter-in-law. She had soon arranged for the queen to be accused of plotting to kill the king, and Arsinoe the First was sent into exile at Koptos in Upper Egypt. Here a memorial built by an Egyptian called Senachrud, who was once her steward, calls the fallen queen the king's wife, the grand, filling the palace with her beauties, giving repose to the heart of King Ptolemy. But such titles were now just memories for her. Even her loyal steward couldn't help but give away her true position in society when it came to writing her name, which he wrote without the royal cartouche surrounding it. She might still have called herself queen in far-off Koptos, but in Alexandria she was nothing. This clinical excision cleared the way for Arsinoe II to take a step that would outrage Greek society, but which, to the Greeks' great surprise, no doubt, ingratiated her with the native Egyptian population. Seeking a throne for the third time, she proposed marriage to Ptolemy, her full brother. Ptolemy now had to choose. Stay true to his Greek roots and shy away from what any Macedonian would certainly have considered incest, or take the opportunity to consolidate his power free from the influence of alien wives or suitors, and make Ptolemaic rule an entirely family affair. Fortunately for both of them, they lived in a country with a 2,000-year precedent for this. Egyptians not only approved of incestuous royal marriages, they preferred them. Royal incest fitted into their religious cosmology, and had been widely practiced by pharaohs at the height of Egypt's power. Though her motives were Greek, Arsinoe could not have made a more Egyptian move, so she took a throne for the third time as wife and queen to her brother, the couple taking the epithet Philadelphus, brother-loving. On her death at the age of 54 in July 270 BC, she was deified by her husband. But she bore him no children during their marriage, so Ptolemy had his children by Arsinoe the First declared as children of his second, divine wife, and heirs to the throne. Reaction in the museum to the announcement of the two Ptolemies' incestuous marriage must have been mixed. It was an idea that sat very uneasily in Greek minds, as did many aspects of this Greco-Egyptian rule. Yet clearly ruling in a manner that to Egyptians at least seemed correct was working, and most Greeks could be practical enough to turn a blind eye to something they might consider unsavoury but could see was profitable. As such, the museum trod carefully, its members rarely explicitly commenting on this alien custom. Indeed, the interest of the museum's scholars was by now, perhaps deliberately, drifting away from the bloody cut-and-thrust of politics toward the more uplifting arena of poetry. The leading intellectual figure at the time was Theocritus, circa 300 to circa 260 BC, an extremely important and influential poet who was the originator of a new form of poetry known as the pastoral idyll. Greek poets preceding him were mostly interested in storytelling, in character and action, not in the intrinsic beauty of nature. Theocritus totally altered that by creating little pictures of rustic life cast in dramatic form. These could be very naive. Sweeter, shepherd, and more subtle is your song than the tuneful splashing of that waterfall among the rocks. If the muses pick the ewe as their reward, you'll win the hand-raised lamb. If they prefer the lamb, the ewe is yours. Theocritus, Idylls. Theocritus's idylls and bucolics were immensely influential, right through to the 18th century AD and beyond, forming the basis for works like Milton's Lycidas, Shelley's Adonais, and Matthew Arnold's Thyrsis. He also wrote extensively about love, often taking up the quintessentially Greek theme of the love of an older man for a youth. Art come, dear youth? Two nights and days away, who burn with love grow aged in a day. As much as apples sweet, the damson crude, excel the blooming spring, the winter rude. In fleece, the sheep, her lamb, the maiden in sweetness, the thrice-wed dam, the fawn, the calf in fleetness, the nightingale in song, all feathered kind, so much thy longed-for presence cheers my mind. To thee I hasten, as to shady beach, the traveller, when from heaven's reach the sun fierce blazes, may our love be strong, to all hereafter times the theme of song. Two men each other loved to that degree that either friend did in the other see dearer than himself. They loved of old both golden natures in an age of gold. Theocritus, Idylls. Whether Theocritus's brief mention of the thrice-wed dam could possibly be an aspersion on Arsinoe the Second is unclear, but we do know that Theocritus was shrewd enough to write openly only in fulsome praise of the incestuous royal marriage, and cast it as the act of divine siblings like Isis and Osiris, which won him much praise and doubtless handsome rewards from his royal patrons. Another court poet was not so prudent, however. Sotades was also in Alexandria at the time, but his was a very different reputation. Known as Sotades the Obscene, he is remembered for having invented his own meter for the obscene subject matter of his poetry. Sotades is sometimes credited with inventing the palindrome, where a phrase reads the same both forward and backward, and a sotadic verse has the opposite meaning when read backward. Almost none of the work of this colourful character has survived, though both Plutarch and Athenaeus noted one line from the satirical poem he wrote about the royal marriage. They said it read, "You are pushing the peg into an unholy hole." It did not amuse his royal patron. According to Plutarch, Ptolemy had Sotades the Obscene thrown into jail. According to Athenaeus, however, Sotades escaped from prison and fled, but he was eventually caught by Ptolemy's admiral, Patroclus, on the island of Caunus. Patroclus did not bother returning him to his master for punishment, but simply had him sealed up in a lead coffin and tossed into the sea. A third scholar at the museum at the time was Lycophron. He was a tragedian and the only member whose name has survived from a group of seven, sometimes eight, tragic poets of the time known as the Pleiades. However, Ptolemy chose to give him the task of arranging and cataloguing all the comedies in the library. This he dutifully did, and he subsequently produced a tract on the subject, On Comedy, which is now lost. In fact, only one of his works has survived, a poem in 1,474 iambic lines entitled Alexandra or Cassandra, which deals with the fortunes of Troy and the Trojan and Greek heroes after the war, ending, appropriately enough for his audience, with a reference to Alexander the Great. It is so riddled with bizarre, little-used words and words invented by Lycophron himself that even in his own lifetime he became known as Lycophron the Obscure. Being hard to understand can be a blessing in a violent and highly charged court, however, and Lycophron the Obscure lived to tell more of his enigmatic tales, which became immensely popular in court during the Byzantine period. But even as his obsequious court poets sought to immortalize their sovereign in verse, Ptolemy II set his sights on more concrete edifices to his glorious reign. His three greatest Alexandrian commissions began with the rebuilding of the museum, which had expanded piecemeal under his father's rule, but had long since outgrown its original premises. In place of the old dormitories and assembly halls, he commissioned a magnificent range of buildings right alongside the royal palace on the waterfront, with expansive lecture theatres, the library and great assembly halls, observatories and plant and animal collections. Finished in white marble and designed to harmonize with the royal palace, it must have been the envy of all the other princes of the time. At this complex's heart stood the museum itself, where the greatest minds in the world could meet and talk and think and write. The first integrated scientific research complex in the world. To provide fuel for their thoughts, there was the Great Library, a place where all the works of the ancient world could be stored and ordered, available to any of the scholars to consult, provided, of course, they had royal permission. Constructed on the waterfront in the royal district known as the Bruchium, it quite early on became known as the Mother Library, whose daughter was to be found in the Serapeum. Linked to the museum by a white marble colonnade, the Mother Library contained at least 10 large interconnecting rooms or halls, each dedicated to a specific area of learning, such as rhetoric, theatre, poetry, astronomy, and mathematics. The walls of each hall were broken up by a series of alcoves where the papyrus scrolls were stored. Off the main rooms were smaller ones where scholars could read, write, or discuss their work, and participate in special studies. It was to be a sanctuary for thought in a violent age, and carved over its entrance was a simple inscription: A Sanatorium for the Mind. Ptolemy's third great building project may also have been conceived in his father's time, but only came to fruition now. If the museum and library stand as testament to the father, it is perhaps this most practical of buildings that should stand as a tribute to the son: the great lighthouse on the island of Pharos. Ptolemy II would no doubt have also been delighted to find that it was this, rather than his father's library or museum, that would go down in history as one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, and become Alexandria's most illustrious icon. The man credited with building the lighthouse, although we are not sure if he was the donor or the architect, was Sostratus the Gnidian, a famed architect and builder who is also credited with having constructed a hanging garden in his hometown of Cnidus in Caria, and a clubhouse in Delphi where his fellow citizens could meet. The task Ptolemy now set him was to solve one of Alexandria's most persistent problems. Built on an almost totally flat coastline, the harbour at Alexandria was hard to locate from vessels several miles out to sea. And there was a further danger. Those ships unwise enough to stray too close to the shore searching for the anchorage would find themselves in dangerous shoal waters, studded with reefs and sandbanks, where all but the most skilful captain might founder. Even with the harbour in sight, the most dangerous reef lay hidden across the entrance itself. Those ships might find themselves wrecked on the shores of Pharos, where the notorious inhabitants of the port of pirates could easily pick them off. There was thus a pressing need to construct some sort of navigational mark that sailors approaching the city could use as a guide, preferably both day and night. In short, a lighthouse. It seems likely that this solution had already been agreed to when Sostratus was summoned by Ptolemy, but aided by the mathematicians of the museum and works from the library, Sostratus was able to propose a structure on a scale that even a Ptolemy could not have expected. The great lighthouse was to be constructed in granite and limestone blocks, faced with white marble. Its total height would be at least 400 feet, that is, about the height of a modern 40-floor skyscraper. Erected on a solid base, it would have 3 levels. The first level would be square and would house all the workers needed to fuel and operate the great light. The second floor would be octagonal in shape, decorated with exquisite statuary, which stared out across sea and city, and where the people of Alexandria might come to enjoy the breathtaking views. The third level would be circular, and crowned with an enormous reflector, quite probably of parabolic shape, another first in scientific design, and made of polished brass. Finally, atop this would stand a huge bronze statue of Poseidon, god of the sea, leaning on his trident. The light was designed to operate both day and night. During the day it was simple enough to just reflect the rays of the sun out to sea, but at night something more was required. For this, a circular shaft ran up the centre of the entire building, which enclosed the spiral staircase that gave access to the higher floors. Up the middle of this could be winched the piles of resinous acacia and tamarisk wood that provided the fuel for a great bonfire, whose light was reflected far out to sea each evening by the great mirror. Though wildly exaggerated claims have been made for both the height of the lighthouse, 1,500 feet, and the visibility of the light, 500 miles, the consensus is that it was visible from about 30 miles out to sea. The location for the lighthouse was obvious, on the island whose name would come to stand for lighthouses everywhere, Pharos. Here it would be most conspicuous, not least to the wreckers and pirates who called the island home. Strabo, who saw the lighthouse in the late 1st century BC, gives us its location. Pharos is an oblong island very close to the mainland. The eastern extremity of the isle is a rock, which is washed all round by the sea and has upon it a tower constructed of white marble with many stories and bears the same name as the island. This was an offering by Sostratus of Cnidus, a friend of the king's, for the safety of mariners, as the inscription says, for since the coast was harbourless and low on either side, and also had reefs and shallows, those who were sailing from the open sea thither needed some lofty and conspicuous sign to enable them to direct their course aright to the entrance of the harbour. Strabo, Geography. The building project took 12 years to complete, and was said to have cost Ptolemy about 800 talents, approximately $3 million at today's gold rates. A story, which may be apocryphal, attaches to its dedication. It's said that when it came to placing a dedicatory inscription at its entrance, Sostratus knew he would have to dedicate it to Ptolemy and his wife, but was determined that he would not be forgotten himself. So he had his inscription engraved in the stone, then had it plastered over, and the dedication to the Ptolemies etched into the plaster. In time, and hopefully long after Ptolemy's death, the plaster would then eventually decay and fall away, revealing his words. Sostratus, son of Dexiphanes the Gnidian, dedicated this to the Saviour gods, on behalf of all those who sail the seas. Certainly, this is the inscription that Strabo and other classical authors record as being carved into the lighthouse. Whether or not it was what Ptolemy saw at its dedication will forever remain unknown. And Sostratus certainly built the lighthouse to last. Surviving several tsunamis and a devastating succession of earthquake swarms, it was still working when the Arabs took the city in AD 642, though about 50 years later the reflector was damaged by an earthquake. Around AD 1165, the Moorish traveller Yusuf ibn al-Shaykh saw that the building was still in use, and confirmed its construction in 3 levels, adding that the base was constructed of massive red granite blocks, joined with molten lead rather than mortar to strengthen it against the pounding waves. He also gives us a rare glimpse inside the building, describing how at that time the first section housed government offices and a military barracks, together with stabling for at least 300 horses. Above this, in the octagonal section, refreshment stalls sold fruit and roasted meats to tourists who had climbed the tower to marvel at the statues that decorated the balconies. Above these, a higher balcony gave visitors a panoramic view over the city and the sea beyond. The third section had changed its use by al-Shaykh's day. The cylindrical tower no longer contained the cresset for the beacon fire, but a small mosque now took its place. Perhaps above this, and crowning the whole structure, the colossal statue of Poseidon, god of the sea, leaning on his trident, still looked down on the tourists crowding around his feet. However, by the time the 14th-century Arab voyager Ibn Battuta, on his way to China, reached Alexandria, the Pharos was in its death throes. At length we reached Alexandria, on April the 5th, 1326. I went to see the lighthouse on this occasion, and found one of its faces in ruins. It is a very high, square building. It is situated on a mound, and lies 3 miles from the city on a long tongue of land, which juts out into the sea from close by the city wall, so that the lighthouse cannot be reached by land except from the city. On my return to the city in 1349, I visited the lighthouse again, and found that it had fallen into so ruinous a condition that it was not possible to enter it. Ibn Battuta, Travels in Asia and Africa. A sad end for such an extraordinary monument. Yet for a building of 40 stories height to survive for more than 1,500 years in an active seismic zone was little short of miraculous. And way back in those heady days when Ptolemy and Sostratus saw their colossal dream rising on the tiny barren island, they must surely have realized that now Alexandria truly was the light of the world. Chapter 7. The Music of the Spheres. I saw eternity the other night, like a great ring of pure and endless light, all calm as it was bright, and round beneath it, time in hours, days, years, driven by the spheres, like a vast shadow moved in which the world and all her train were hurled. Henry Vaughan, The World. The beacon on Pharos that now drew the traders of the Mediterranean to the world's greatest emporium was also attracting other travellers. Among the scholars of the Aegean, word was out that Alexandria offered an environment where it was possible to think the unthinkable, to challenge the fundamental and apparently self-evident certainties of the world. The museum and library were fast becoming a new type of institution, a community of the world's thinkers, working together to decipher the mysteries of the universe, the first true university. The grain pouring out of Alexandria's port continued to fund the work of the scholars now pouring in, giving Ptolemy II the pick of the most brilliant scholars of the age to tutor his son and heir, Ptolemy III. He in turn demonstrated as he grew up that, if anything, he was even more passionate about collecting, copying, and archiving books than his father and grandfather. Strangely, it would not be philosophy that provided the foundation for Ptolemy III's own rule, but war and tragedy. Following the death of his father in 246 BC, Ptolemy III succeeded to the kingdom without opposition, but the death of the old monarch had been seized on elsewhere to foment trouble. As part of a peace treaty between the Ptolemies and the rulers of the Seleucid dynasty of Syria, Ptolemy II's daughter, Berenice, had been married to Antiochus II Theos, who had agreed to repudiate his previous wife, Leodice. When news of the pharaoh's death reached Syria, Antiochus clearly considered himself no longer bound by that peace treaty and returned to his former wife. It was a deadly mistake, as Leodice immediately poisoned her former husband and declared her son the new king. Berenice and her son were bound to oppose this and called on her brother Ptolemy III for help. War was inevitable. By the time Ptolemy had raised an army and stormed across Egypt and up into the Middle East, news was emerging that Leodice had arranged the murder of Berenice and her son. Infuriated, the pharaoh raged through the region in a campaign that left the whole area stunned. One inscription from Adulis in Eritrea proudly compares this to the magnificent Middle Eastern exploits of the great Ramesses II. When Ptolemy returned to Egypt, his baggage train was laden with spoils, enough to comfortably support even the most lavish basileus. So rich was he that he offered to pay for the rebuilding of the Colossus of Rhodes. The 160-foot-tall statue, including pedestal of the god Helios, had stood at or near the harbour entrance to the island since its dedication 56 years earlier, in thanks for Ptolemy I's assistance in the wars of Alexander's successors. The statue, as high as the Statue of Liberty, had recently collapsed following an earthquake. But the Rhodians, fearful they had offended the god, refused the offer to rebuild. The statue then spent another 800 years lying broken on the shore, although even fallen it was still a major tourist attraction, Pliny the Elder noting that few people could manage to reach their arms around the thumb. But Ptolemy did not need the Colossus. He had other, more important statues in his baggage train. The wagons that rolled back into Alexandria brought with them the 2,000 statues of Egyptian gods that the hated Persian king Cambyses had removed from Egypt. For this, the people loved him and gave him the title Euergetes, the benefactor. With Ptolemy having this title and more money than he could spend, the rest of his reign was both peaceful and prosperous. Patronizing the greatest minds of his age was thus both pleasurable and affordable, and Alexandrians could turn their minds from war to contemplating far greater things. During the war, a legend emerged which perhaps hints at the growing importance of one particular new area of science in the city. After Ptolemy left for his campaign, his wife, a Cyrenian, also called Berenice, went to the temple of Aphrodite to pray for her husband. Here she promised to sacrifice her famous long hair to the goddess if Ptolemy returned safely. When he did, she duly honoured the pledge and cut off her hair, having it placed in the temple. The next day the offering was found to be missing, leaving the king and queen furious. Only one man could calm them, an astronomer called Conon. He told the queen that the hair had not been stolen, but that the gift had so pleased the gods that they had taken it up into heaven. That night he proved it to her, showing her a small group of stars which he called Gomma Berenices, Berenice's hair, and the constellation retains that name to this day. By this time, another astronomer and mathematician, Aristarchus of Samos, who had arrived in the city as a young man sometime before 281 BC, was also enjoying Ptolemy and Berenice's largesse. He had turned his extraordinary mind away from the earth to contemplate the heavens, not simply to interpret signs of the zodiac, so beloved by the ever-nervous rulers of the ancient world, but to understand the mechanisms of the universe itself. What he would see in the heavens was far removed from the theological ideas of gods and creation prevalent in his day, far removed even from the concepts of the universe discussed in the museum. He had brought to Alexandria a unique heritage, and to look into his world is to look into the very dawn of science. Aristarchus came from Samos, birthplace of perhaps the most famous philosopher, mathematician, and astronomer of all time, Pythagoras. Pythagoras, who lived from around 580 BC to around 500 BC, stands almost at the dawn of rational philosophy, that is, at the point where reasoning began to supplant faith as a means of understanding how the universe and everything in it works. But he had one predecessor, a man who many classical writers assert actually met and taught the young Pythagoras when he was about 70 years old. His name was Thales of Miletus, and he was known throughout the classical period as the first of the seven sages of ancient Greece. Before Thales, those seeking answers as to how or why things occurred in the universe invariably referred to the gods. Divine interventions caused earthquakes, changed the seasons, played with the lives and health of puny mortals, and so on ad infinitum. People had only a hazy idea of the shape of the earth and the surrounding cosmos. Many believed the earth was flat and round, floating boat-like on an all-encircling ocean. They then added to the disk of earth, sitting in its ocean saucer, some form of pillars or supports. The Egyptians placed them at the cardinal points and anthropomorphized them as the arms and legs of the sky goddess Nut, holding up the dome of the heavenly firmament which sun, moon, and stars traversed in a regular manner. Outside this cosmic eggshell, some placed water, which could descend from above in the form of rain and snow, or well up from below in springs, lakes, and wells. But what was all this actually composed of? What was the fundamental matter? Before Thales, and for many after him, the answer to this question was invariably divinity. Call it soul, spirit, or God, the fundamental matter was divine, untouchable, metaphysical. Thales, however, preferred water. Water is, after all, fundamental. It can be solid, liquid, or gaseous, and without it there can be no life. Right up until the 19th century AD, scholars believed that life could generate itself spontaneously in water. As the early metallurgists had discovered, even metals could be reduced to liquids with sufficient heat. And with the seasonal inundations of the great rivers of the ancient world, the Nile, Tigris, and Euphrates, water created earth in revitalizing silt deposits and islands in the deltas of these great rivers. But this is where Thales made his great leap. He asserted that earthquakes were the result of waves, disturbances in the water on which the earth floated, and not the acts of irate gods. This was one of the greatest revolutionary ideas of all time. Of course, today we know that earthquakes are not caused by ripples on a cosmic ocean, but it is Thales' idea, not his conclusion, that matters. In attributing a natural phenomenon to mechanics and not gods, he took the universe out of the hands of divinities and claimed extraordinarily that everything was understandable, knowable. The furious sea god Poseidon was no longer shaking the planet as he strode across it. Something physical was making the world shake. This idea alone marks the beginnings of science. Thales is credited by all the great masters, Plato and Aristotle among them, with being the founder of natural philosophy. Aristotle reporting simply that Thales considered that he had found the originating principle. "Thales says it is water," he proclaimed. Though his own writings are lost, stories about his life and thoughts were widely reported in classical times, particularly his musings on astronomy. Diogenes Laertius devotes his first book in The Lives and Opinions of Eminent Philosophers to Thales. After having been immersed in state affairs, he applied himself to speculations in natural philosophy, though, as some people state, he left no writing behind him. For the book on naval astronomy, which is attributed to him, is said in reality to be the work of Phocas the Samian. But Callimachus was aware that he was the discoverer of the lesser bear, Ursa Minor. For in his iambics he speaks of him thus: "And he, 'tis said, did first compute the stars which beam in Charles Wain, and guide the bark of the Phoenician sailor o'er the sea." Diogenes Laertius, The Lives and Opinions of Eminent Philosophers. Diogenes goes on to report that other people claimed that Thales did write two books, one on the solstice and the other on the equinox, thinking that everything else would easily be explained. Both Herodotus and Xenophanes are said to have praised him for being the first person able to predict the eclipses and motions of the sun and to have really studied astronomy. A slightly dubious claim, as the Chaldean-Babylonian astronomers were considerably further advanced than the Greeks in charting the movements of the celestial bodies. Diogenes also attributes to Thales numerous other advances, all of which flowed out of his realization that the universe was rational and could be understood. He tells us that Thales affirmed the path, known as the ecliptic, along which the sun appears to move during the day, calculated the size of the sun, and was even the first person to call the last day of each month the 30th, presumably implying that he devised a new calendar. He also considered more intangible things, and we are told that some again, one of whom is Cyrillus, the poet, say that he was the first person who affirmed that the souls of men were immortal. But Aristotle and Hippias say he attributed souls also to lifeless things, forming his conjecture from the nature of the magnet and of amber. Diogenes Laertius, The Lives and Opinions of Eminent Philosophers. It was Thales' method, rather than his results, that had begun a revolution, and he believed that with that method he could understand everything. Plato even credits him with being the first absent-minded professor in history. He tells us that the philosopher would wander at night, gazing up at the stars and not looking where he was going. On one occasion this led him to fall into a ditch, where a pretty young girl found him and teased him, saying that he was so eager to know what was going on in heaven that he could not see what was before his feet, before wryly adding, "This is applicable to all philosophers." The heir to Thales' innovative view of the world was a man whose name still strikes fear into the hearts of schoolchildren, Pythagoras. Like that of Thales, none of Pythagoras's own work has survived. In fact, the cult which he led, half religious, half scientific, followed such a tight code of secrecy that it may well be that they forbade the writing of their secret formulas and discoveries. But even in his lifetime, Pythagoras was such a towering figure that his biographical details were written down by others, and some of these accounts have survived. Many busts of the great mathematician also survive, although none are contemporary, so they probably bear little relation to what he actually looked like. The only physical feature we do know about is a striking birthmark on his thigh. His father was a merchant from Tyre, in Syria, who was granted citizenship in Samos after he donated grain to the island in a time of famine. His mother was a native of Samos. Pythagoras grew up on the small island, but also travelled extensively with his father, visiting Tyre, where he was taught by Chaldean magi from Babylonia, renowned for their knowledge of astronomy and astrology, and other learned Syrians. His educators also taught him to play the lyre and to recite Homer and other poetry. It was on his travels, the sources tell us, that he encountered both Thales and his pupil Anaximander, and attended the latter's lectures on geometry and cosmology. It is also said that Thales advised the young man to travel to Egypt to study with the priests there, just as Thales himself had done 50 years previously. Pythagoras took the old man's advice. At that time, Samos was allied to Egypt, which apparently gave Pythagoras access to the temples and their scholar-priests, who accepted him among them. There are so many close parallels between the society which Pythagoras later set up in Italy and the operation of the Egyptian priesthood that we can assume that it was in Egypt that he developed his ideas for his own school. This would explain his cult's emphasis on secrecy, the striving for purity, and even the refusal to eat beans or wear any sort of animal skins, all of which were Egyptian priestly taboos. 10 years after he arrived in Egypt, the country was invaded by Cambyses II, king of Persia, and Pythagoras was captured and sent to Babylon. There, we are told by the philosopher Iamblichus, he gladly associated with the magi, and was instructed in their sacred rites, and learnt about a very mystical worship of the gods. He also reached the height of perfection in arithmetic and music, and the other mathematical sciences taught by the Chaldeans. Iamblichus, The Life of Pythagoras. Around 530 BC, or earlier, Pythagoras left Babylon and made his way back to Samos, where he founded his school, which he called the Semicircle. There all manner of philosophical issues were discussed, his pupils sitting in a semicircle around the master. But back at his birthplace, Pythagoras was again drawn into the political and diplomatic life of his people, which greatly distracted him from his philosophical work. It is also said that the local people disliked his Egyptian style of symbolic teaching, and he used this as an excuse to move the school to the Greek city-state of Croton, now Crotone, in present-day southern Italy. Here he re-established the school with an inner circle known as the Mathematikoi, who lived in the school, had no possessions, were vegetarians, and lived according to the strict regime prescribed by the master. The members of the semicircle were required to live by a set of tenets which stated that, at its deepest level, reality is mathematical in nature. Philosophy can be used for spiritual purification. The soul can ascend to union with the divine. Certain symbols have special mystical significance. All brothers and sisters of the order must observe strict loyalty and secrecy. Following the strictures of the group, Pythagoreans were hence the first to devise a consistent cosmos based on pure numbers. By associating a point with one, a line with two, a surface with three, and a solid with four, they arrived at the sacred and omnipotent total number of 10. They believed that 10 would also be the key to understanding the structure of the cosmos. A new element in this cosmic glass-bead game of mathematics and astronomy which Pythagoras introduced was music. Noting that vibrating strings produce harmonious tones when the ratios of their lengths are whole numbers, he went on to arrange the universe into similarly harmonic groups of spheres, even claiming that the music of the spheres really existed, though we have lost the ability to hear this background noise. According to Pliny, Pythagoras thought the musical interval between the Earth and the Moon was a tone, the Moon to Mercury a semitone, Venus to the Sun a minor third, Mars to Jupiter a semitone, and so on, so that the heavenly bodies actually played tunes as they waltzed past each other. The Pythagoreans' universe was one of absolute mathematical perfection. All heavenly bodies were, for them, perfectly spherical and moved in perfectly spherical orbits. At the center of the universe, Pythagoras placed the Earth, then the Moon, then the Sun, and next the planets. The whole universe was finally wrapped in an outer sphere of the fixed stars. Arthur Koestler catches the essence of the structure perfectly. The Pythagorean world resembles a cosmic musical box playing the same Bach prelude from eternity to eternity. Having turned the universe from a whim of the gods into a mathematical machine, Pythagoras set the stage for the objective study of astronomy. It was a pupil of Pythagoras named Philolaus who would first suggest that the reason for the rising and setting of the sun, moon, and stars might not be that these celestial bodies moved across the sky, but that the earth itself was spinning. Sadly, he went on to obscure this brilliant and counterintuitive revelation by inventing two new astral bodies apparently invisible to the human eye. First, he had the Earth spinning around the cosmic hearth, an invisible fire at the center of the universe. On the same sphere, there was another invisible object, a counter-Earth, responsible for generating certain eclipses. The next sphere was our Earth, then the Moon, the Sun, the five known planets, and finally the sphere carrying all the fixed stars, bringing the total number of celestial spheres up to the desired mystical number 10. Pythagoras would have been proud of him, had it not been such a cumbersome and fanciful creation. The idea of a rotating Earth would only be taken up again some centuries later in Plato's lifetime by an astronomer named Heraclitus, who first proposed that the Earth rotated once each day on its own axis. This mortally offended Plato, who still insisted that while the Earth remained perfectly still at the center of the universe, every other celestial body rotated dutifully round it and us. But this troubled Heraclitus. He had observed how some of the planets, in particular Venus, do not move smoothly through space as the perfect Pythagorean model insisted. Rather, for some nights they advance, but then they stop and appear to go back on their own course for a few days. What, he asked, could make the planets wander so? It was a pressing problem, and one which even echoes into our language today, the word planet deriving from the Greek word for wanderer. For Heraclitus, the solution was obvious. At least two of the planets, the so-called inner planets Venus and Mercury, must orbit around the Sun, not the Earth. And it was this complex movement that, viewed from the Earth, seemed to make them wander. This astute model quickly caught on, and became known as the Egyptian system. Its only flaw was that it didn't go far enough. It still had the Earth at the center of the universe, and the Sun, now with its two moons of Venus and Mercury, obediently circling it. This, then, was the confusing view of the universe that Aristarchus of Samos brought with him to Alexandria. But under her clear skies, and aided by the new facilities of the museum's observatory, the fog of confusion was about to lift, leading to one of the greatest scientific discoveries of all time. Aristarchus had studied with Ptolemy II's tutor, Strato of Lampsacus, a man whose devotion to the study of nature earned him the label the physicist. Trained in Aristotle's Lyceum in Athens, Strato took his master's passion for the rational study of nature a step further by claiming that there was no need for any divine explanation of the universe. He declared that there was just nature, and that all things natural could be subjected to observation, measurement, and experimentation. In this respect, he is considered the first atheist philosopher, but more important for our story, he essentially saw the universe as a mechanism, which operated without the need for transcendental, divine forces. It was this idea that he impressed on the young Aristarchus, and which gave his pupil the confidence to ask a previously unasked question. If the universe is simply a machine, how does it work? That we know the answer he devised in Alexandria is thanks only to a near fluke of history. Only one of Aristarchus's works has come down to us, known as On the Sizes and Distances of the Sun and Moon. At first, this seems disappointing, as it is largely assumed to be an early work in which Aristarchus appears to accept the predominant geocentric universe of those times. But on closer scrutiny, even this early, fragmentary work is very revealing. First, the very notion that we can attempt to measure the size and relative positioning of the three largest-seeming celestial bodies, Earth, Sun, and Moon, is a very bold opening gambit. It assumes that these are free-standing entities in stable relations with each other and of calculable dimensions. It must be said that the figures he derived for the sizes of these bodies are wildly inaccurate. His own calculations led him to believe that the Sun was about 20 times the size of the Moon, and 18 to 20 times as distant from the Earth as the Moon was. In fact, the Sun is about 450 times as far away from us as the Moon. He also calculated the diameter of the Sun as about 7 times that of the Earth, and therefore estimated that the Sun's volume was about 300 times the volume of the Earth. In fact, the diameter of the Sun is about 300 times that of the Earth, its volume about 1.3 million times that of the Earth. However, modern mathematicians have examined his propositions in great detail, and find that, effectively, Aristarchus was not let down by his math, drawn from the ever-reliable Euclid, but by his observational data. So although Aristarchus was enormously wide of the mark, he hit the bullseye in a far more crucial way. What he established, at least to his own satisfaction, was that the Moon was the runt of the litter, and that the Sun was vastly bigger, more voluminous, and presumably heavier than the little Earth. So why then should this huge celestial Titan, at least 300 times the volume of the Earth, be dutifully pirouetting around so small a planet every day? For the priests the answer had been simple, because that was how the gods had ordained it. But there were no gods in Aristarchus's universe, so he had to seek answers elsewhere. But at this point, just as he was about to make his great discovery, his trail appears to have gone cold. None of Aristarchus's other work survives, and his brilliant idea might have remained unknown in the modern world, were it not for a small aside in a book by another great mathematician, Archimedes. In his book, The Sand Reckoner, Archimedes set out to demonstrate methods for dealing mathematically with extremely large numbers, such as the number of grains of sand which would fill the universe, hence the title of his book. Of course, to arrive at the largest number possible, he had to find a description of the largest theoretical universe known in which to place his grains, and for that he turned to Aristarchus. having explained to his patron, King Jilun, that most astronomers believed the Earth to be the centre of the universe around which everything else rotated, he added, almost as an aside, "But Aristarchus has brought out a book consisting of certain hypotheses wherein it appears, as a consequence of the assumptions made, that the universe is many times greater than the universe just mentioned. His hypotheses are that the fixed stars and the sun remain unmoved, that the Earth revolves about the sun on the circumference of a circle, the sun lying in the middle of the orbit, and that the sphere of fixed stars situated about the same centre as the sun is so great that the circle in which he supposes the Earth to revolve bears such a proportion to the distance of the fixed stars as the centre of the sphere bears to its surface." Archimedes, The Sand Reckoner. Here, then, was Aristarchus's great thought, preserved only as a reference in another book. Archimedes, for his part, did not even believe it to be true, only being interested in the sheer scale of the model he proposed. The response to Aristarchus's hypothesis of a heliocentric solar system was perhaps to be predicted, and may in itself help to explain why so few of his own works survive. Contemporaries were horror-struck by the new role this Alexandrian astronomer gave to the Earth and, by implication, to the people on it. How dare he take away their special position at the very heart of creation? One of them, by the name of Cleanthes, wrote a treatise entitled simply Against Aristarchus. This has since been lost, so we don't know on what grounds he attacked Aristarchus, but Plutarch would later comment that Cleanthes thought it was the duty of the Greeks to indict Aristarchus of Samos on charges of impiety for putting in motion the hearth of the universe, i.e. the Earth, this being the effect of his attempt to save the phenomena by supposing heaven to remain at rest and the Earth to revolve in an oblique circle while it rotates at the same time about its own axis. Plutarch, On the Face Which Appears on the Orb of the Moon. We don't know if Aristarchus was ever indicted or whether a trial ensued. It would perhaps seem unlikely in the liberal atmosphere of Alexandria, though we should not forget Socrates' fate and the threats laid upon both Plato and Aristotle. But at the very least, this bold new theory provoked a reassertion of the official orthodoxy from several scholars, including Dersilides, who argued, somewhat pompously, the need to assert that the Platonic model of a fixed Earth with its hearth of the house of the gods, countered by moving planets and the rest of the heavens, was correct. He claimed that it was essential to reject those who brought to rest the things that move, and set in motion the things that by their nature and position are unmoved, insisting that such a supposition was contrary to the theories of mathematicians. In the end, these reactionary responses held sway. Aristarchus had no significant followers in his own generation or the following ones, and his only known disciple was a Chaldean named Seleucus, who lived by the Tigris River and adopted Aristarchus's teachings around 150 BC. Why this rejection of Aristarchus should happen is one of the greatest riddles of the ancient world. Aristarchus's heliocentric universe seems so clearly true to us, who have the benefit of modern science and space travel to help our imaginations, that it's hard to envisage what it must have been like to be committed to an Earth-centered view of the cosmos. Yet that was the view that prevailed for thousands of years throughout antiquity, and which would continue as the only acceptable model of the solar system until the 16th century AD. But there are two other profound reasons why Aristarchus's beautifully mathematical, mechanical universe was too far ahead of its time to be acceptable, even to the scholars at the museum in Alexandria. First, we need to return to the age-old dichotomy between faith and reason, or religion and rationality. Even the great Plato had comparatively recently insisted that while our fallen, corrupted world may be analyzable using rationality, the really pure, uncontaminated cosmic bodies were to be found in the skies, or rather, the heavens. Here were the seats of pure spirituality, divine beings, if you like. To reduce these heavenly spheres to mere lumps of rock shunting around an infinitely huge void was tantamount to heresy. Hence Cleanthes' determination to indict Aristarchus for impiety, godlessness, not bad science. But at an even more profound level, great minds like Archimedes balked at the idea of a sun-centered universe because it took the spotlight off us humans. An Earth-centered universe is also an ego-centered universe. Why should the gods create the universe at all if not to give us humans somewhere to play and to puzzle about? Plato had already decreed that humans were at the very zenith of creation, and that we had already gone through 5 phases of evolution, the last, most elevated phase being that of the philosopher, the lover of wisdom. Aristarchus's universe was a vast and lonely place, where the Earth was relegated to the role of just another planet, circling around a fixed sun, shrouded in a vault of impossibly distant stars. No god marked out this Earth as special. It had become just another wanderer. To demote the Earth to this was to deny that the universe was built by the gods for us. That was like denying both our descent and our ascent. Most preferred a more comfortable, human-centered universe, and this conception would survive right down to Darwin when he scandalized Victorian society with his notion that people might be descended not from God, but from mere apes. So the comet-like genius of Aristarchus flared across the Alexandrian skies, then vanished. But not forever. In AD 1543, Copernicus published his revolutionary heliocentric model of the universe just before his death, which possibly occurred only hours after he received the first printed copy of the book. It has even been argued that Copernicus may have died of fear, fear of the wrath of the Catholic Church at a man of the cloth daring to suggest that the Earth goes around the sun and not vice versa. Certainly we know that he sat upon his manuscript for decades, steadfastly refusing to publish it. More recent research reveals, however, that his anxieties may have been driven by guilt as much as by fear. For in the original handwritten manuscript, there were several references to Archimedes' The Sand Reckoner, which of course contained his summary of Aristarchus's book on the heliocentric universe. These references have, however, been systematically removed from the printed version of the text, and no mention is made either of Archimedes' book or of Aristarchus. And still today, nearly all of us credit Copernicus with the discovery of the true nature of our planet's motion around the sun. It's particularly ironic that Aristarchus is sometimes referred to as the Greek Copernicus, when in fact it is Copernicus who should be referred to as the Polish Aristarchus. Aristarchus's books, including his work on the sun-centered universe, were of course lodged in the Great Library in Alexandria, which is very probably where Archimedes read them. He was about 25 years younger than Aristarchus. While Aristarchus's great ideas never caught on in his lifetime, his work was known and read, proving that from just a small observatory on the grounds of a temple, Alexandria was already turning the universe and the world with it on its head. The gods had begun to release their grip, leaving humans to stagger into the daylight and begin to explore their world. Chapter 8. The Little O. His face was as the heavens, and therein stuck a sun and moon which kept their course and lighted the little O, the earth. William Shakespeare, Antony and Cleopatra. While Aristarchus put the earth and heavens in motion, it would fall to another Alexandrian to attempt the seemingly impossible and actually measure them. In the process, he would transform disciplines as diverse as mathematics, astronomy, and geography forever. Aristarchus had told the Alexandrians, "We lived on a planet ceaselessly circling our sun." But it would be Eratosthenes who would describe the nature of the craft on which he travelled. Eratosthenes, son of Aglaus, was born around 275 BC in the city-state of Cyrene, now Shahat, in present-day Libya. It was a city firmly bound into the Alexandrian world, having been conquered by Ptolemy I, but one with a reputation for free thinking encouraged by the liberal constitution that the first Greek pharaoh had granted it. Even in Eratosthenes' youth, the city already had many famous institutions, including a medical school, and many famous sons, among them the philologist Licinius and the great Callimachus himself, both of whom personally tutored the young man. Some years before, it had also nurtured one of the more individual thinkers of the day, Aristippus, a companion of Socrates, and his grandson, also called Aristippus, who had founded his own Cyrenaic school of philosophy. Here it was taught that only the present moment exists, and that immediate pleasure is the only purpose of any action. It was to Athens, however, that Eratosthenes was soon drawn, to the places where Plato and Aristotle had taught, and here he came under the influence of the sceptics. At the academy, the young Cyrenian met the greatest philosopher of his day and the institution's scholarch, or director. Arcesilaus was a man famed for his wide circle of friends and correspondents across the Mediterranean, his quick wit, his broad interests. His love of wine. One source reports he died during a drinking bout when 75 years old, and, according to some sources, his harsh teaching methods. As a sceptic, Arcesilaus taught his pupils to argue both sides of a question, to see a problem from other angles, and then to remain sceptical, that is, to withhold judgment. In arguing against the Stoics, some of whom Eratosthenes also counted among his friends and tutors, the sceptics proposed that one cannot rely entirely upon one's senses, and that the Stoical view that truth came from clear perception followed by certainty was wrong. It was a philosophy that would have a profound impact on Eratosthenes, not merely in his philosophical musings, but in the actual practical business of his life. Clearly, during his time in Athens, the members of the academy had already noted something special in Eratosthenes, and he had soon joined the international network of thinkers, which led him inexorably toward the Ptolemaic court, Alexandria, and the great library. His Athenian master had, after all, been a pupil of Aristotle's friend and successor, Theophrastus, and the Alexandrian project must already have been well known to him. He was also becoming known to the Ptolemies. For all the peace and glamour of Ptolemy III's court, one problem did play on the pharaoh's mind. Who would tutor his son? For every Ptolemy, this was a matter of vital importance, as over the preceding three generations they had each in turn benefited from the most privileged education available. Ptolemy I had learned from Aristotle, his son had been taught by Strato of Lampsacus, and his son by Apollonius of Rhodes, author of Jason and the Argonauts. When news reached Alexandria of this bright new star at the academy, Ptolemy III knew he had found his man, and the invitation was duly issued. At the moment Eratosthenes stepped ashore in the great harbour of Alexandria, one of the brightest periods in the city's history began. Yet, with a certain irony, even as he climbed the marble steps to the palace to meet his new charge, he was approaching the little boy who, years later, would begin to bring the whole Ptolemaic edifice tumbling down. For now, however, this was the greatest opportunity of the young philosopher's life. He was under the protection and the patronage of one of the wealthiest and most liberal rulers of his day, and before him lay the full resources of the museum and library, where he could explore the entirety of the knowledge of the world. And that is exactly what Eratosthenes wanted to do. He wanted to know everything. Court life must have been tiresome for the young tutor, as he struggled to instruct the self-indulgent young Ptolemy IV, who, unlike his forefathers, seems to have taken little interest in learning any of the skills that had created his dynasty. But there was a greater reward for a patient tutor close at hand. It was not long after arriving in Alexandria that Eratosthenes became not only a member of the museum, but the librarian of the great library, following the death, or possibly the retirement, of Apollonius of Rhodes. Now began an explosion of work in a huge range of fields. The scholars in the pharaoh's pay were not, like modern academics, required to become specialists in one subject. There were certainly some, the physicians and mathematicians among them, who were highly focused on a single area, but the work of a philosopher in Alexandria was generally considered to include the exploration of all fields of knowledge and thought. The boundaries of art and science had not yet been fenced off, and a great mind could wander freely. Men such as Eratosthenes might write about mathematics and poetry, astronomy and literary criticism, comedy and geography. And that is exactly what he did.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.